Okay, folks, hello. Hope you're well. This is Jeff Sachs of Atidna Rebbe Yeshiva. Sorry for the technical delays, and sorry for my voice kicking out in the middle last week. I want to review some of the things we were in the middle of last week when we had to a little bit abruptly end, and I want to go over a few points, including clarifying some things that came up in some of the questions that you sent in this week, and I do welcome those questions and comments as we go along. Last week, I made a comparison between the halachic man and the lonely man of faith, Rabbi Soloveitchik's two perhaps best-known and most significant essays. I reminded you that in the lonely man of faith, we're introduced to two characters, Adam the First and Adam the Second. Adam the First, who represents the characteristics of man as created in the first chapter of Bereshit versus Adam the Second. In the second chapter, Rabbi Soloveitchik had pointed out that there were these very interesting differences in focus and in content in how the story of creation is twice told. And he explained that these reflect two disparate aspects of the human personality. Adam the First is the kifshuha. He's tasked with going out and conquering the world, with subduing it. Adam the Second is la'avda u'lishamra, to create a sense of covenant, to create a sense of community, to form relationships with a fellow man, and through that with God. In the Lonely Man of Faith, this dialectic between the first Adam and the second Adam, between conquest and covenant, the second Adam who has to give up something, has to sacrifice something of himself in order to form community and covenant with others. This dialectic, the tension between the two, is never resolved. It's not meant to be resolved. It's built into creation. And we don't choose between Adam the First or Adam the Second. One is not superior to the other. They're two components of who we each actually are. In halachic man, however, if you recall last week, I compared cognitive man to Adam the First. In halachic man, the dialectic between this worldliness, as represented by cognitive man, the scientist, and otherworldliness, as represented by the homo religiosus, the religious man, that is a dialectic which cannot be resolved. It has to be overcome in the model of halachic man, the katuv hashlishia machriya b'neihem, the third resolving verse, who not merely synthesizes them, but stands above them, who supersedes both of them. And both the cognitive man and the homo religiosus are inferior to the halachic man. The lonely man of faith, the value of both, of Adam the First and Adam the Second, conquest and of covenant, are meant to be preserved. Let me go one further. These two realms of cognitive man and homo religiosus play themselves out in there, and we've started exploring this now, and it's going to take us the next number of weeks till we fully flesh this out. But I understood from some of the questions that I received during the week that it's worth kind of giving a sneak peek of where we're going to help us understand the lay of the land. The discussion of this worldliness, the world of material, the physical universe that we occupy, and the transcendent realm, the other world, what I've termed here the world of the spirit, this should not be confused with the terms that we often use in this discussion, olam hazeh and olam haba. That's in the eschatological realm. That's the discussion about the end of time and the messianic era and the world that we occupy now and what happens to us after we die or after resurrection. That's a very different conversation. And don't let the similarity between the language of this worldly and otherworldly confuse you. We're talking here about the two worlds, the physical realm that we can occupy, that we can touch, that we can physically interact with, that we can measure, that we can experiment on when acting in the realm of the scientist, of the physicist, and the world of the spirit. Not a world that exists far, far away or in a different time and place. A world that indeed lives within us, the transcendent realm, but not the realm which is part of the physical, measurable universe, at least not as experienced by us. Cognitive man, the scientist, is, let me get the marker up here. Hold on a second. Cognitive man, the scientist, is completely oblivious to the transcendent realm. The only thing that registers on his radar is the physical universe that we occupy. And he is he is completely unaware of the realm of the spirit.
Okay.
Homo religiosus, on the other hand, feels this profound tension between the two realms. Homo religiosus is not a man that exists only in the realm of the spirit. He is aware that we occupy the material world, but he is torn by the tension that exists between the two of them. And he tries to resolve that tension by fleeing the material world, by negating the material world, and attempting to reach the world of transcendence. Halachic man rejects both positions. Halachic man makes an almost opposite movement from homo religiosus, and he attempts to bring the realm of the spirit, the realm of the transcendent, into this world. To bring it down into this world. Of course, up and down are just metaphorical, because it's not actually like we thought as children that, you know, God lives up in the clouds and like a palace, you know, sitting on a cloud the way we saw it maybe in the cartoons. But that's just metaphorical talk of higher and lower, of upper and lower, of up and down. But he attempts to bring the realm of the spirit, the realm of transcendence, down into our world through the mechanism of the halakha. Now, why is it that halachic man both rejects the attitude of cognitive man as well as that of conventional religious man? Well, there are a few reasons. On the first plane, halachic man cannot be like cognitive man because halachic man, in fact, does recognize the realm of the transcendent. Cognitive man is boxed into his worldview once he rejects the idea that there is anything beyond it. Now, again, in parentheses, I received two emails this week from two of you, both of which more or less are asking the same question, or bringing evidence from the contrary of a statement that Einstein made, a statement that some other scientist made about how when they engage in science, they're seeing the face of God and all those things. Yes, it's true, and we can marshal thousands of such examples and thousands of such surveys that show that people that work in the sciences often are more religious by whatever characteristics of being religious the takers of any such survey are using are more religious than the professors that work in the humanities. That's irrelevant to this conversation. Because those scientists that are surveyed in such matters, those statements by an Einstein, who after all is, I mean, you think of scientists, you think of Einstein, it's almost synonymous, none of them actually are cognitive man or homo religiosus. Because in the real world, we don't exist in the centrifuge where we've been completely separated. You have to remember that we're working within these SRA, the platonic forms, these ideal topological characters who don't actually correspond to any actual live person that we're ever going to meet. Einstein was not a cognitive man. And, I don't know, the Pope, not this current Pope, who seems to be quite interesting, but the previous Pope is not actually a homo religiosus in the pure sense. Right? We are all more complicated than that because we haven't gone through that centrifuge. Since halachic man does recognize that there is a transcendent realm, so he has to reject the worldview of cognitive man, or he has to go beyond the worldview of cognitive man. That being said, halachic man is like cognitive man in the sense that he approaches the world through, in the words of Rav, an a priori way of perceiving reality. A priori is the Latin way of saying what we say in Hebrew, lechatchila, from the outset. That you have a preconceived mode by which you view and interpret the world. And in science, scientists approach the world with all types of sets of givens. And in all, think in mathematics. But mathematical problems usually begin with the set of givens. Given that A equals 1 and B equals 2, calculate something or other. If you're examining some physical property, so you work under the givens of the laws of science as accepted at the moment of the experiment.
Right.
In other words, in the words of Mr. Scott, I cannot change the laws of physics. Now, it would be really handy if you could. Now, that's because as you're hurtling towards the black hole and the warp drive is out and you're about to be smashed to smithereens, well, if you could change the laws of physics, it would save you. But given that the laws of physics are universal constants that cannot be altered, even within the realm of science fiction, you want a certain amount of consistency. Otherwise, there's no tension. Because if you can always pull a supernatural solution to every problem out of your hat, so then there's no tension for the viewer or for the reader in science fiction. Even within the realm of science fiction, you still have to bump up against certain realities. In order to maintain some plausibility. So that's the scientist. The Isha Halakha is similar to the scientist in that he approaches the world with a set of a priori modes of perceiving reality. And that is what the Halakha is. And the comparison here between Halakha and science, and again, when the Rav talks about cognitive man as a science, I think we can presume he's I'm not the first to point this out, others have as well. It's probably most useful to think of the scientist being used, the example, the field of science being used here as theoretical physics, although presumably it would work for other realms of science, as well. But that halachic man approaches the world with a set of preconceived way of viewing things, and there's going to be a very evocative passage in a dozen or so pages where he gives examples of halachic man goes out into the natural world and he sees all types of natural phenomena and he interprets it through the prism of the halakha. But I'll hold off on those specific examples until we get there. But those of you who know it, it's among the most famous passages in the essay. You may know what I'm referring to when he talks about the spring and the sunset However, a halachic man also cannot accept the worldview of Homo religiosus because he rejects the negation of the material world. Halachic man, and in this way, halachic man really is a very Jewish, particularly in the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik views the Jewish worldview. And in this way, we see the degree to which Homo religiosus represents a worldview which is a religious worldview, to be sure, but not a conventional Jewish worldview. And in fact, it smacks much more of Christianity, even Catholicism. Homo religiosus rejects the compromise of the material world and strives for a world of pure spirit. And you can think of attitudes in certain religious worldviews that view this world as impure, that view the drives and appetites that humanity possesses as a function of being created within the natural world, that those drives are impure, are sinful. That's not the Jewish worldview. And we've talked about this, it seems to me, on numerous occasions in the past, both in our other studies of Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, as well as in the past when we've had an opportunity to learn the Rambam's teachings together. And this really is one way in which the Rambam, if you recall, years ago, many of you were with us when we learned the Rambam's Shmona Prakim, where the Rambam also has a lengthy diatribe against asceticism. That asceticism, you know, rejecting the pleasures of this world, you know, he decries as a completely un-Jewish approach, that asceticism was never a mainstream Jewish attitude, although, of course, you can always find the counterexamples. But if you look at the history of Jewish thought, asceticism was never a mainstream Jewish approach. And the halachic man says, given that we were created by God in this way, that we are, and as I said before, even in this context, that we are on one hand no different than beasts. We have bellies that need to be filled. We have appetites and drives of all types that need to be accounted for. That need to be accommodated, that need to be answered, that need to be fulfilled, that those drives cannot be inherently impure. They cannot be sinful. It's inconceivable that God would have created us in that way. That doesn't mean anything goes. Quite the contrary. Part of the religious quest, even for the halachic man, is to rein in those appetites, to not be slaves to our passions, but neither to negate them, to channel them into proper, healthy ways. So halachic man cannot accept that idea that this world, the material world in which we are created, is inherently bad, is something which has to be escaped. Because of that, he'll go on to say later on that that's the reason that halachic man fears death, whereas in some religious worldviews, death is the great escape. It's the great release. It's the joy of shuffling off this mortal coil to a better beyond. That's not the attitude of the halachic man. Because in this world is the world in which the halacha can be actualized. The halacha is a system that's designed to be put into place in this world. And therefore, we have to be this world focused, but not to the exclusion of the transcendent. Peter, I'll come back to your comment in a second. There's another attitude that causes halachic man to reject the worldview of homo religiosus. And it's the phenomena that we've seen in the history of religion where a focus on the next world, a focus on the transcendent, on the otherworldly, is spiritually distracting because it draws our attention away from this world. And this world, the world we happen to be occupying at the moment, this world is a world where there's suffering. It's a world where there are widows and orphans and people who need our help. And the focus away from this world has a consequence that it sometimes draws our attention away from our duties in this world, particularly our duties to fellow man. And then, of course, think of all of the crimes that have been perpetrated in this world throughout history in the name of religion, as an attempt to focus on the next world. If one is only concerned about the eternal soul of heathens, so then that becomes cause to treat them or mistreat them in all types of way in this world, if you can justify it based upon the benefit to their souls in the next world. And from that ethical concern, the halachic man cannot accept the worldview of the homo religiosus. And that's why he needs to find a third path. And that third path is through the halacha. One other point that I want to clarify from last week. Last week I made mention of Rudolf Otto and his important work, The Idea of the Holy, which is a work that seems to have had some influence on Rabbi Soloveitchik. He certainly knew it and made reference to it. And that phrase, the mysterium tremendum, the encounter with the holy, with the awe-inspiring mystery, is an idea that the Rav utilizes, but there's one significant difference between the Rav's thought and Rudolf Otto's thought, and that the numinous, yes, there you go. One significant difference is that for Otto, the holy, the realm of the holy, is always otherworldly. It's always, pardon the expression, wholly removed, wholly. For the Rav, the realm of Kedusha, for the halachic man, the realm of Kedusha is always this-worldly. And he goes on to make this point, which we'll encounter, and with this I'll stop giving away some of the endings, that Kedusha is always in this world, and it's always, or almost always, because there are counterexamples to this, almost always produced through human agency. That the source of Kedusha is the halachic man, the halachic woman, implementing God's divine plan within this world, and that's what generates Kedusha. There are counterexamples to that because not every realm of Kedusha, of holiness, of sanctity, actually fits into that. Most specifically, the realm of Shabbat. Shabbat seems to be a kind of entity of holiness that exists independent of a human involvement. Whether anyone in the world would observe Shabbat, keep Shabbat, be aware of Shabbat, it would still in fact be Shabbat on the seventh day with all of its holiness. But that's one counterexample to the general principle that all holiness, and we'll go through some specific examples, although we in our most recent series on the Rav's essay, Kodesh and Chol, Sacred and Profane, the archives of which, of course, are available, we also expanded on that theme. So those are some of the, again, just by way of answering some of the questions and comments that came in, that's a little bit of the roadmap of where we're going with this. Let me look at some of these comments that have come in. So Peter, I must confess, I am not holding in Jacques Lacan, but I'll take your word for it, and the other folks are welcome to look at Peter's comments here about Lacan. Okay. Let's go back to the essay. Here we are on page 10. Page 10 in Halachic Man. We're talking about homoreligiosis. We're talking about homoreligiosis. Religious man, the Ish Hadat. And he brings the example of Eov. Job, the suffering Job, who raged against the heaven because he sought to render an accounting of the world and error. Remember, he quoted those psukim, that God's answer to Eov, after Eov finally questions God after all of his suffering, it basically is, Eov, how can you question how I run the world when you have absolutely no understanding of how the world works, of how I run the world? So Eov would rage against heaven because he had sought to render an accounting of the world and erred, accepts upon himself the divine judgment. And then he took him to that effect. He sinned with his proud and overly bold venture to grasp and comprehend the secret of the cosmos. He confesses and returns to God with the discovery of the mystery in the created world and of his inability to understand that mystery. The ultimate goal of religious man is the question, dost thou know? That's the question that God poses to Eov. Do you have any idea how the world works? And through all those metaphors of the natural world. The path which leads him to this aim is the complete cognition of being. A strange polarity of disclosure and hiding, revealing and concealing, breaks forth and seizes hold of the consciousness of the man of God. He discloses in order to hide, reveals in order to conceal. Therefore, this stance is devoid of that agnostic, devoid of the slightest trace of that agnostic doctrine which denies objectivity of knowledge and effaces the truth and validity of the cognitive act. The viewpoint that has been described here neither brings the religious individual to rebel against the kingdom of knowledge and cognition, nor does it lead him to adopt that exaggerated and distorted position of Tertullian. Tertullian was a second, third century Christian thinker, was called an apologist in the sense of trying to give rationale for religious belief, for Christian belief. He lived in North Africa. He lived somewhere in North Africa, I believe. So Tertullian has this quote, which, like, if you search for it, it turns out that the quote may not have actually been something that he said. It may have been a later encapsulation of what he was thinking, but it's always ascribed to him. Credo qui absurdum est. I believe because it is absurd. So that position, belief because it is absurd, which has some currency to it. You can understand why it's an attitude, whether people are aware of this particular ancient Christian philosopher or the phrase itself, but the idea that, on one hand, belief from an objective point of view on one hand, belief, faith, there's something absurd about it. You know, it's viewed from a completely objective point of view. But the absurdity of it is part of what gives it its power. There's an interesting article just this week in the New Yorker magazine by that very wonderful writer, Adam Gopnik. He writes for the New Yorker on an array of things about atheism. On one hand, the question of, like, throughout much of history, in the debate between believers and atheists, the burden of the argument was on the part of the atheist. At a certain point, the burden of argument shifted onto the shoulders of the believer. And the believer had to argue against the position of atheism. But certainly in the ancient world, the presumption of truth was on the part of the believer. So that idea of belief, because it's absurd, a position born out of the bitter despair and terrible disillusionment of a man who, with his intellect, knocks upon the gates of the universe that stands shut and locked before him. At the end of the day, there's just certain things that we cannot understand. There's certain questions that we will not get answers to. On the contrary, Homo religiosus is eager to cognize natural phenomena and understand them. Right? It's not that, here, go back here. The model, let me clear this. Remember, hold on a second. Cognitive man rejects the transcendent realm. But the flip side of that is not that Homo religiosus rejects the material world. Quite the contrary. It's not true that Homo religiosus does not also think. It would be too simple to set it up as cognitive man is the thinking man and Homo religiosus is the believing man, and the believing man doesn't think. That's not the case at all. Homo religiosus, religious man, is a thinking, spiritual man. And the fact that he is a thinking, spiritual man is what creates the tension. Were he to outright ignore, were he to be completely oblivious to the material world, there would be no tension. But because he is aware of the material world he occupies, he feels the tension, and he seeks to resolve the tension by escape. But insofar that Homo religiosus is also in the world, in the meantime, he does cognize, he does think, he does examine, but the entire purpose of the examination is the polar opposite of what motivates the examination on the part of the Homo religiosus. Homo religiosus is eager to cognize natural phenomena and understand them. But knowledge itself for him is the greatest and most difficult riddle of all. Knowledge and wonder, cognition and mystery, understanding and secrecy, the law and the unknown, these constitute a unified phenomena which reveals itself to us in a twofold fashion, in all accordance with one's perspective and point of view. However, knowledge does not forfeit its objective status and intrinsic significance as a result of the teku, the unresolvable problem. Teku is an Aramaic term that we use in the Gemara a question, an unresolved question. The unresolvable problem that peers out of its windows. On the contrary, the riddle adorns and embellishes cognition, bestowing upon it the splendor of eternity. homo religiosus, when he examines the world, does so knowing that at the end, the questions that are left after the examination are part of what drives us. In this respect, the teaching of our great master Maimonides, of blessed memory, is typical. On the one hand, Maimonides ruled the knowledge of God is the first among the 613 commandments. Yesodius Avot Bamud HaChachamot Leidah She'esham Matzui Rishon. The Rambam begins his magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah, in accounting for the mitzvot by saying that the knowledge of God is the foundation. That there's a mitzvah to know God. What's often described as a mitzvah to believe in God, which is somehow, of course, circular reasoning. You know, it's like when the children ask the parents, why do we have to do this? And the answer is because we're the parents. That there's a mitzvah that God commands us to believe in God is something of a circular reasoning. As a matter of fact, the Ramban, the Nachmanides, famously disagreed with the Ramban. And although, of course, Nachmanides also believed that we must believe in God, he does not count it as one of the 613 mitzvot, because he believes that that is on a level of that's a mandate that's a prerequisite to any discussion of mitzvot. It exists categorically in a different box. Before you get to the discussion of mitzvot, 613 mitzvot, there's this overriding obligation to believe. Because without belief, the other 613 mitzvot are certainly irrelevant. So for the Rambam, knowing God is the foundation of all foundations. On the other hand, the Rambam maintains the doctrine of negative attributes, which denies all possibility of knowing God. In other words, the first mitzvah, the foundation of all foundations, the pillar of all wisdom for the Ramban, is to know God, Leida, to know Him, to understand Him. I'll come back to that momentarily. But the Ramban maintains, in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guide to the Perplexed, that we are not capable of knowing God. That all we can do is know Him through negation, through His negative, through negative attributes. We know what He is not. We know that God is not corporeal. We know that God, the Rambam maintains, is one of the foundations of, one of the principles of faith, that God has no physical form whatsoever. And that's what motivated the Rambam so much. That's what motivated the Rambam so much at the beginning of the Mor Nevuchim, was that discussion of metaphor. Since God has no physical properties, then how can it be that the Torah describes Him in physical ways? And the entire opening of the Guide to the Perplexed is a treatment of how metaphorical language works, what it does, what the function of it is. Hold on a second. So Elisheva, hold off on that question. I'm going to come back to it at the end. On the other hand, my mind tells the view that knowledge of God is not in the realm of human cognition. That we cannot know God merely by thinking about Him. Are there two greater opposites than these? Nevertheless, Maimonides himself struggled with this antinomy and devoted two chapters of the Guide to the Perplexed too, and I gave you links to those that were interested in reading these directly. The substance of his answer is that negative cognition does not forfeit its status as cognition. I remember when I was a kid, we had these, there was this toy, and it was like a hunk of clay, and it came with, it came like in this foil wrapper, and it was about this big. And it came in a foil wrapper, and you got like this little putty knife, and you would carve away at the putty, at the soft clay, and inside was like a little figurine, like a plastic figurine. And, you know, it was Ki'ilu, as it were, to like, you know, let the kids think he was a sculptor. Because after all, what does a sculptor do? I mean, a classic sculpture, Michelangelo, you know, you take this, you take a block of marble, and you carve away, and you reveal, as it were, the statue of David that's embedded within the marble, you know, on the level of the imagination of the sculptor. But here, there was an actual plastic figurine embedded in this lump of Play-Doh, whatever it was, and, you know, the kid pretends that you're peeling away, you know, the clay, and you're left with the, whatever it was, Mickey Mouse, I don't remember what it was, inside. So that's what negative cognition is, that you peel away all of the, what he's not, and that gives you the kind of contour, a sense of, through the negation, what is, except here there's no actual plastic figurine in the middle. It's just this kind of a vacuum. So negative cognition does not forfeit its status as cognition. However, we know that the entire phenomenon of negative cognition is only possible against the backdrop of affirmative cognition. That's to say that something is not X. So you still need to have a sense of what does it mean to be not X. We negate with respect to the Creator all of the attributes that we have affirmed with respect to created beings. So we think in whatever way, whatever it means to be a created being, meaning a physical form occupying this world, subject to time, subject to space, subject to change, God is not like that. He is unchangeable, he is eternal, he is non-corporeal, he has no physical body or properties. But you need to understand what it means to be created in order to have an inkling of what it means to be the opposite. And again, to use that same metaphor which I made reference to a week or two ago, as the Rambam himself used in a different context. But the Rambam describes our inability to understand what Olam Haba is, the next world, is like fish living out of the ocean. I mean, a fish can't conceive of what it's like to live an amphibious life. And I think I gave the point that it's also impossible for us to imagine what it's like to be a fish. Because that very act of imagining what it's like to be a fish is an unfish-like act. That level of metacognition is unfish-like. So the very act of imagination itself means that we don't really occupy the mindset of the fish. And if we did, I mean, it's like a thought experiment. If you really could imagine what it was like to be a fish, that would mean that you would give up the ability to then stop imagining that you're a fish, and then you would really be a fish. So you'd be stuck. Therefore, in order to arrive at the negation, we must engage in an act of affirmation. The act of negation is reconstructed out of the very substance of affirmation. And what constitutes affirmative cognition is not the cognition of the cosmos, the attributes of action. And here, Very good, Miriam. 2 points for you. And here, we come back to the Rambam. The Rambam famously said two halachot. One towards the beginning of the Sefer Mazda and one at the very end of the Sefer Mazda. The Rambam's first of the 14 books of the Mishneh Torah is Sefer Mazda, the book of knowledge, the book of knowledge, which is despite its placement at the head of a halachic work, is a philosophical work and was the subject of some controversy in its day. The Rambam says the following. What is the path to loving and fearing, loving and being in awe of God? When a person will consider God's acts, we can't know God, but we do know how God has acted in history. We know how he acts in history, and we know what he has created. Through an examination of history, although you have to be careful because what does it mean to examine history? There's always a level of interpretation. To examine the physical world, so, you know, scientists can debate what's the proper way to go about doing that. But what's the proper method? But we all agree on what the physical world is. This rock is part of the physical world. That star out in the heavens are part of the physical world. The grains of sand on the beach are parts of the physical world. History is a little more complex. But if we look at how God acts in history, at his actions and his creations, that will lead us to a very great desire to draw near to him, and it will cause us to praise and extol and desire with a great desire to know him. This is the doorway. It's the entrance. It's the opening towards the love of God. And that's why the Rambam, who after all was also a scientist, says that the examination of physics and metaphysics, of the Maaseh Bereshit and the Maaseh Merkava in the rabbinic nicknames, of what we would call nature, science, and philosophy, are these two parallel paths to know God. But through the examination of the physical world, we come to know he who created the world. Towards the end, at the very end of the Sefer Mazda, at the very last halakha, the very last chapter of Hilchot Tshuva, the laws of repentance, which also serves as a kind of conclusion to the whole of the Sefer Mazda. The Rambam says, "Davar yeduo varur she'en ahavat HaKadosh Baruch Hu nekasheret b'libo shel adam ad sheyishkeh batamid." It's clear that the love of God does not become fixed in one's heart until you will be completely occupied with God constantly. V'yazov kol ma shebaolam chutz minen. Completely focused on God. Kimo shetziva v'amar b'chol levavcha. Like we say in Kriyat Shema, to love God with all your heart, b'chol nafshecha, all your soul. Eino ohev HaKadosh Baruch Hu ela bedat sheyedeehu. You can only love God with a measure of how much you know him. So to go back to, I think Elishevi, you asked the question, yes? share the right impression. No, so Chris, we're not talking about proofs of God's existence here. Yeah, let's go back. Alicia, I misread your question earlier. We're not talking about proofs of God's existence here. It's a given. Belief in the existence of God is a given within the context of these halakhot. But a deeper, more profound understanding and love for God, that the knowledge of God and the love of God are directly linked. V'apia de'atia aza. And according to the measure of one's knowledge will be the measure of his love. In ma'at ma'at dim harbe harbe. If only a little, then only a bit. If very much, then a lot. The more you know God, and again the sources of knowing God are through examining how he works in history and examining his creation, the created world, and also through philosophical examination. So the more you know, the greater will be your love. And therefore you have to dedicate yourself to the wisdom and the knowledge and the scholarship that will provide you with the information that you need in order to know God. According to the amount of ability, according to the ability that each person has to know and understand, given that full knowledge is not possible because we are separated like fish from the dry land from a full understanding. And that, of course, is the Rambam's vision of Achrit HaYamin, of the Olam Haba, of the world where we will be freed of our physical existence, which does limit our knowledge of God, and then it will be plugged in directly to that knowledge. But in the meantime, as far as we are here in the created world, and being part of being created means that we are of a limited ability to understand a different reality, so to whatever degree we can invest in gaining the knowledge, so then we will know more, and the more we know, the more we will love Kefisha Barnu Behilchot Yisodei Torah, the earlier halakha that we mentioned. Let's skip ahead now a bit where we left off towards the bottom of page 12 here. The old familiar proverb of negative theology, the goal of knowledge is to know not, refers, as it is clear from the proverb itself, only to the goal and the aim, but not to the process of cognition. The knowledge of God which leads to love and fear, concerning which we commanded in the Laws of the Foundations of what we just looked at, is the cognition of the attributes of action, the cosmos, and this cognition is entirely affirmative. We look at the world because understanding the world, the real world, the material world that we live in, leads to knowledge of God. But that is the kind of cognition that Homo religiosus engages in. It is not the kind of cognition that cognitive man, even though both of them are examining the same physical world. Their examination leads them in different directions. Again, we are not casting judgment on either of them. We are diagnosing these two personalities in order to understand how the third character, Halach man, will come and stand on the shoulders of both. Cognitive man looks at this world. Homo religiosus strives for a spiritual world, but he looks at this world also with a desire to reach a higher transcendent realm. Because by looking at this world, we can also, as it were, I'll be poetic, we can also see the face of God. But of course, that's also an imperfect metaphor, for God has no face. Let me just look at these comments before we end. It is the manifestation of perfect other. Okay. Look, friends, you see from Peter's comments that he knows a lot. But I'm not equipped to address some of the comments because they're in fields that I'm inferior. So we will rely on him for his knowledge in these areas. Shalishava writes, paraphrasing the Rambam, to know that there is a prime being, the positive commandment, and the knowledge of God is not the knowledge of permission. Right. Okay. Right. It's that knowledge. Belief is presumed. Belief in the way that we use it colloquially is presumed. Faith, as we use it, is presumed. Peter, gaze into the abyss gazes into you. Paraphrasing Nietzsche. Ah, that's a good one. Even though we know what Nietzsche said about, you know, God. So, okay. Next week we will continue from chapter 4 on page 13, which also goes further into this question of continuing examination, the comparison of homoreligiosis and cognitive men. Let me just put up in the chat box. I mentioned that at the end of the month I'll be visiting Toronto and New York and New Jersey. So up in the chat box is a link to my schedule of where I'm going to be and where I'm going to be speaking, both on Shabbatot and during the week. If any of you are any place in those areas, I'd be very happy to meet you in the real world. You know, either at one of those things or to arrange time to get together. At another time. Why not LA? The weather is great. I am sure that the weather will be much greater in LA than it will be in New York or Toronto. And I'm afraid a little bit that the weather is going to wreak havoc as it has been doing. But the real answer, Miriam, is that no one in LA invited me. So when someone in LA invites me, I'll be happy to go. So we will continue next week. Please again, try to read ahead.